I'm Tom Hall. This is a special archive edition of Midday. Today, the privacy paradox. No one likes the idea that Facebook, Google, and who knows who else are mining the data from our phones and laptops and tablets and tracking our every move when we're online. If that's true, then why do we willingly hand over so much personal information about ourselves? Do we really care about online privacy? Plus, there are new laws regarding what information service providers can collect and sell. How are the rules of the road changing? Why does it matter, and what will it mean for us collectively and individually? The philosopher Furman de Brabander, legal expert Melanie Teplinski, and cybersecurity expert Avi Rubin join me to talk about the new age of online privacy. We're on tape, so we can't take your calls today. This special archive edition of Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you're joining us this afternoon. Today, our topic is online privacy. Virtually everything we do and say online can be collected and sold. Later in the show, I'll be joined by two scholars who think a lot about the technical and legal ways in which our privacy is up for grabs and how that might be changing now that we're in the Trump era. But first, a discussion about what we might call the privacy paradox. We say one thing when it comes to online privacy, but many of us act in decidedly unprivate ways when we're on the internet. We often say that we don't want to be spied on by big government or by big data, the companies that collect and sell information about every place we go online. So that's what we say, but our behavior suggests that we don't really care about our privacy as much as we say we do. We post all sorts of intimate details about our lives and our families. It's not unheard of for people to post confessions to crimes online, or in many horrifying instances, the crimes themselves. We voluntarily allow apps to know exactly where we are at all times. That information is valuable to all sorts of companies and sometimes to certain government agencies. So do we perhaps care about privacy in some abstract way, but not enough to behave online in a way that would keep our information more secure? And if we say we value privacy, are we as a society able to articulate what's wrong with losing privacy? Well, my first guest is a professor and philosopher who has thought a great deal about our relationship with online privacy and why privacy matters. Furman de Brabander is an associate professor of philosophy at MICA here in Baltimore, where he's taught since 2005. He's the author most recently of the book Do Guns Make Us Free? He's working on a book about privacy, and an article that he wrote recently on the subject caught our eye. So Furman de Brabander is here with me in Studio A. Good to see you, sir.
Thank you.
You are welcome to join our conversation about internet privacy. 410-662-8780 is the number here at Midday. Our email, midday at WIPR.org, and our Twitter handle to follow us at Midday Tom Hall. So, Furman, you wrote a piece in a journal called Aeon, and you talked about how digital media has so radically transformed our notions of a couple of things, shame and intimacy. What do you mean?
Well, I mean that our online behavior suggests that we are rather shameless. We are revealing details about our lives pretty freely and openly, and it's kind of shocking. And they are these are also sometimes either mundane details or intimate details. And it's just surprising that we are so willing to offer this up, even though we talk the talk of privacy otherwise. At least we feign horror at the kind of revelations that Edward Snowden reveals about what the government is looking into and collecting about us. And a lot of people I've noticed, you know, the private sector is even more aggressive when it comes to collecting data about us. And when I talk with people about those kinds of things, such as, you know, the famous example of where Target knew that its customers were pregnant and then sent coupons, directed coupons. And then when I discuss that with people, they also suggest that they are appalled by this, and yet our behavior otherwise is quite remarkable. One way I put it is that I've said that we are the agents of our own surveillance because we offer it up. We're, you know, the powers that want to know about us, they have, at the end, they have rather little work to do because we're so busy telling everybody about us, where we are, what we're doing, what we think, and our most basic facts of our lives.
The trade-off, though, the upside for all this sharing is convenience in
That's
a lot
right.
of ways. I mean, if you've got news to share, I've got a new job, or, you know, my wife is pregnant, or mm-hmm. our daughter just got accepted into college, you can let everybody know at the flick of a button.
Well, what's so interesting from a philosophical standpoint is that, you know, I saw the ad for the recent, is it the Apple Watch? They are using the word freedom over and over again. This stuff is sold to be empowering and liberating. And yet from a philosophical standpoint, all the philosophers who study this issue, and you know, at least the most prominent ones who talk to, you know, surveillance and spying, they all point out the same thing, that we are consistently less free as we are surveyed and watched. And yet we are sold the instruments of our surveillance on the promise of freedom and liberation and empowerment. And indeed, with this cell phone, I feel a lot more powerful. I feel a lot more free and independent. I can do so much more.
But
so there's the paradox.
And the paradox is there's a line then between surveillance and communication.
I mean, absolutely.
Where, you know, I did an event at the City Lit Project, the City Lit Festival, a couple of weekends ago with this wonderful Nigerian author who lives here in Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
She said that the essence of love mm-hmm. is being known. This mm-hmm. is Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. She said the essence of love is being known.
Yes.
Knowing that someone's paying attention, someone's caring.
Right.
I mean, social media allows us all, in our own way, big and small, mm-hmm. to be known.
Absolutely.
It's about love, isn't it?
It is about affirmation. It helps our egos, that's for sure. If I post something and I know it is liked by certain people, that makes me feel, yes, I'm affirmed in my lifestyle and in my choices and what I think. So there is a certain amount of neediness that is on display there, that's for sure. But, you know, in thinking about, you know, how we use our devices to make us freer, you know, the concern is that when we, to the extent that we know we are watched, to the extent that we know we are followed and surveyed by some who knows who's watching, the government or Target, and who knows exactly what they want to know, the worry is that that kind of compulsion will work itself insidiously so that we will all silently and freely conform our lives. That's the angle that I'm interested in.
Freely conform our lives.
Yes, I know. That's another paradoxical statement. But the point is, I'm drawing on the work of Michel Foucault, a French philosopher who talked a lot about this. He says that surveillance is the optimal form of oppression in a democracy where you know, the citizens think they are free. And the way it works is this. If you are watched by you don't know who, and indeed, when I talk to people, I say, are you aware that in your online dealings and your digital dealings that you're watched, they all admit they are. They have no idea by who or to what extent, but everyone admits, at least rationally, that they are. If you know you're watched, but you're not sure to what end and to what purpose exactly, you're going to modify your behavior, maybe in small ways, to conform to what you think is the ideal, what said power might want. You will live less dangerously. You'll live more safely. And so the concern is in the democracy that our freedom is undermined to that extent. And the kicker is that we do this because we're not sure exactly who is watching us for what end. We make these changes of ourselves. We do this on our own free will.
And so no one is quote-unquote forcing us to behave differently.
And so the illusion of freedom is there.
We're choosing to behave differently.
Exactly.
Because we know we're being watched.
We're choosing to conform, put it that way. And so the concern for democracy is that, you know, democracy would seem to require independent, free-thinking, and courageous citizens. And this is pointing in the other direction.
So when it comes to shame, mm-hmm. shame, and I guess Foucault is one of the people who talked
about Plato.
This. And Plato himself.
Plato is my principal one I'm thinking of
on,
here.
On shame. So shame is a necessary component mm-hmm. of a moral life.
According to Plato, yes.
Because you've got to have certain things that are going to be abhorrent to mm-hmm. you morally in order
right.
to avoid that behavior.
That's right.
So confession, mm-hmm. which so many people do online,
that's right,
is liberating because it unburdens people. You talk about this in your piece.
That's right.
It's the unburdening of shame.
That's right.
So isn't that necessary to do? You can't just walk around with a bunch of shame cooped up inside.
That's right. Well, that's where I'm torn. I do admit that confession is liberating and is intended to be, in its original sacramental form, it is intended to be liberating in a way. Interestingly, though, I am also thinking of the philosopher Foucault in this regard. He argues that confession is rather something also that meets the demands of power. This is what the powers that be want. They want us to be confessing animals, as he puts it. The powers that be want us to feel that we must divulge the truth about ourselves, that truth must be outed, that it cannot stay cooped up and held in. I'm torn at that point. I do feel that there's something liberating about this confession, but I don't know. I'll be honest with you. When I look at the nature of things that my friends on Facebook are divulging, I'm not really sure how liberating it is. To mention that you do an update. I'm at Starbucks right now, or I was so drunk last night. These kinds of things that people, I don't know. I'm evaluating the moral and the political significance and value of these things.
Yeah, when it comes to value, that's a whole other thing.
Oh, yes.
The fact that you're at Starbucks isn't something I necessarily need to know to live my life. If you want to tell me Facebook, you're welcome to, but I could care less.
Does the NSA need to know that? Does it matter to them? Would Target like to know? Probably. What does this do to me as a democratic citizen? I'm also interested in that. Ultimately, my interest as a political philosopher. What does this mean about us as citizens?
Because you write in your piece that there's no better way to divide and subdue a people.
That's right.
And seduce them into self-regulation, what you've just been
talking about,
this conformity.
Right.
No better way to do that than to expose their perversions, but promise absolution. That's a wacky statement for me. I mean, is the NSA promising absolution?
No, but the traditional notion of confession as such is absolution, right? Just by getting it off my chest, I'm absolved, But it's true. We are posting our perversions online. We're sharing them for the world. Well, not all of us, but many are. It's just this curious phenomenon that we see. But the absolution would not come from any benevolent power that is then blessing us afterwards. But this is just simply this imperative that Foucault talks about in Western civilization's desire to get it off our chests. You see, this is something he sees operative in modern science, in Western science, as well as Christianity. This notion that the truth must be outed, it must surge to the top. And we as persons, we must do the same duty with our own soul, and we must out our sins. But of course, this is always happy news for the powers that be. They get to read us like an open book. And from a political angle, the concern is, for democratic citizens, the concern is that this is a ready, a manual for how anyone, any would-be tyrant, can then manipulate us and take advantage of us with this information in hand. We are handing it over.
You note that social media puts itself out as a public space, but in fact it acts more like a private venue because of this has to do with sort of tribalism, doesn't it?
That's right.
Because you're connected in Facebook to people who are putatively of like mind.
That's right.
Right? This whole fake news phenomenon that we started seeing, in the last couple of years has to do with people of like mind deciding that information that they're sharing with each other is in fact accurate, even if it isn't. So there's this notion that if I put it out there, I will have this affirmation from other people who say, attaboy, attagirl, way to go.
And then your own prejudices or views are not contested, as is supposed to happen in the public sphere. I mean, it looks to be, at least at this point in history, maybe the jury's still out, but it looks to be that social media is pretty abysmal as a public square. We were told in the early heady days of the internet, this was going to be super. This was going to be, the lifeblood of democracy. And yet what we see is increasing fragmentation of the public and people not speaking to each other and across the divide, and then becoming ever hardened in their own views. So this is very troubling indeed. And that's bad news for democracy, clearly.
Well, but don't we see an awful lot of people who disagree with each other whacking away at each other on social media? I mean, all sorts of people, you know, are responding on Twitter and on Facebook, on Instagram, to things that they see with which they vehemently disagree. And matter of fact, the level of discourse, the civility, has attenuated to a startling degree. People often note that they're saying things online that they'd never in a million years say face to face.
There is a different value to face to face public discussion and debate. And I think that that is something that is lost on social media. I'm always amazed by the nasty emails I get from people. I won't say, you know, in various parts of my life. And then when I meet them face to face, they're completely different. And I think there is something more productive in discussing with people face to face, because then you have to contest them on the reasons. You know, there's the emotional factor. You have to see how they're sticking to their views. There's something about this digital communication where people become hardened in their views and they lash out. And that lashing out is not productive, really.
Furman de Brabander, he's an associate professor of philosophy at the Maryland Institute College of Art here in Baltimore. He's working on a book about online privacy and the paradox that we've been talking about. Coming up after a break, we'll be joined by Melanie Toplinski. She's a privacy expert who specializes in cyber law and policy issues, as well as Professor Avi Rubin from the Johns Hopkins Information Security Institute. They're going to join me to talk about online privacy in the Trump era. The rules are changing, and we'll talk about what those changes mean, and we will do our best to get your calls and comments. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, to follow us on Twitter @MiddayTomHall. Furman de Brabander, many thanks. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
We'll be right back after a break. Stick around.
Listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you're with us. By the way, coming up on the program tomorrow, the author Madison Smart Bell will be here. He's got a great new novel. It's called Behind the Moon, and we will talk about it tomorrow here on Midday. If you're just joining us today, we're talking about online privacy in the era of Donald Trump. So what's on the legal landscape and what changes are the new Congress enacting when it comes to laws regarding the Internet? Melanie Toplinski is a cyber law and policy expert and an adjunct professor at American University's Washington College of Law. As a lawyer, she has advised international clients on a broad array of technical and policy positions. She began her career as an analyst at the National Security Agency, and then she worked on encryption policy and a wide range of information technology policy issues in the Clinton administration. She joins us on the line from the studios of WAMU in Washington. Melanie, welcome to Midday.
Good afternoon, Tom. It's a pleasure to be with you.
And Professor Avi Rubin is here with me in Studio A. He's the technical director of the Information Security Institute at Johns Hopkins University, where he also teaches computer science. He specializes in the areas of cybersecurity and applied cryptography. He's the author of 5 books on information and computer security. Avi, welcome back to Midday. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
You are welcome to join our conversation if you'd like. Our phone number at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. And to follow us on Twitter @MiddayTomHall. So, Melanie, let me ask you to sort of summarize changes that went into effect. President Trump signed a law that changed some of the policies that were to have gone into effect that were suggested by the Obama administration. Tell us what those involve and what's different now than the rules and the laws that the Obama administration had proposed.
Sure. So during the Obama administration, a set of rules had been proposed by the Obama FCC, and they were scheduled to take effect in December of 2017. What the rules would have done is they would have required customers to give permission. It's called opt-in, but permission to share for ISPs, which are Internet service providers, to share data about users' web browsing and app usage. Now, when we're talking about ISPs, Internet service providers, we're talking about the folks that sell Internet access for mobile phones or for home. So folks can think about Verizon, AT&T, T-Mobile, Comcast. Those are the Internet service providers. And those Internet service providers would have needed to get their customers to consent before the ISPs could share information about the web browsing data and data about how we use our apps with third parties. So during the Obama administration, the rules were passed. They were supposed to take effect in December. And when Trump took office, Congress decided to pass, to repeal those rules. But it used a specific tool called the Congressional Review Act. And so not only did they repeal the regulations, and Trump signed the bill that repealed the regulations, so that now took effect, not only did they repeal the regulations, but they prohibited the FCC from making substantially similar rules in the future.
And Avi Rubin, do these new rules concern you as a person who studies this quite vividly?
I think there's definitely reason to be concerned. Those new rules that the Obama administration enacted were enacted for a reason. They were enacted because the ISPs have access to everything that you do online. Anything that comes in and out of your computer passes through your ISP, and that can include information such as your children's names, your health data, your social security number, things like that. And the reason the Obama administration enacted these rules was because they felt that the ISPs had too much access to too much information and that people ought to have the right to be able to decide whether or not that information should be sold, not just to know about it, but to, in fact, allow that to happen. By repealing these rules, the government is now saying that the information that comes out of your computer and your mobile device that your ISP says is fair game for them to sell for marketing purposes and to make huge financial benefit using your own private information without any say from you.
As a practical matter, Avi, would anybody in their right mind agree to having their information sold? I mean, what's the upside for the consumer, right? If Verizon says we'd like to sell your information, and by the way, we're not giving you any of the money, why would anybody say yes?
I think this is a huge lose for the consumer. I don't see any benefit. I mean, some might argue that you're better off getting targeted ads that are for things you actually care about than getting random ads. But I think that that kind of avoids the main issue, which is that there are these huge databases of information now being collected about you, and those are being sold, and you have no idea how far and wide those pieces of data are getting.
And Melanie Teplinsky, at issue here as well is who regulates broadband companies? Who is in charge of overseeing these internet service providers? Does this law bring some clarity to that, or does it change who was the overseer from past administrations?
Yes, so this is a case where we need some history. There's been a longstanding debate about how ISPs, internet service providers, should be classified. And back in the early 2000s, ISPs were subject to one part of the Telecom Act, which was called Title I. And this meant that they were not subject to heavy regulation by the FCC. In 2015, the FCC under the Obama administration made a major change. They reclassified the ISPs as what are called Title II. So now that they're regulated under Title II, they're essentially treated like any other telecommunications carrier, like an AT&T. And this means that they're subject to rather heavy-handed regulation by the FCC. It means the FCC has much greater authority to decide what rules the ISPs must follow. And so there's a broader debate about how to classify ISPs. That's played into here in part because until the Obama FCC rules took effect, the FTC, which is the Federal Trade Commission, had a set of voluntary guidelines to which the ISPs were adhering. After the Obama rules came out, the FCC rules came out, the internet service providers needed to follow would have needed to follow FCC rules. This may not sound like a big distinction, but what Republicans were saying is that the rules should be the same for the ISPs and other companies. They should all be subject to the FTC rules. What Democrats say, and this builds on the point just made, is that ISPs are different from Google or from Facebook, so different rules are okay, particularly because ISPs do have the potential to see and collect much more than the so-called edge providers, the Googles and the Facebooks of the world. Moreover, because there's a lack of competition, it's really hard to change which ISP you use. It's easy in many cases to choose to use a different website, but it can be very hard, and in some rural areas, there's really little or no choice about the providers, the internet service providers we use. And because of that lack of competition, Democrats have argued in large part that the ISPs should be subject to more severe rules.
And Avi, put this in a global context for us. Obviously, if the United States Congress makes rules about how ISPs function in America, can they control in any way how these ISPs may function in China or Europe or Africa or any place else?
Well, my understanding is that the laws that we have, the FCC rules, et cetera, are limited in jurisdiction to the United States. And as we know, the internet is global. But as far as consumers go in their homes in the United States and the information being collected about their browsing habits or what apps they're using or what geolocation information there is, such as where a particular person is, all of that information is available to the ISPs. And if there is no regulation that requires customers to opt in or that requires them to get some kind of a permission, then they are free to sell that. And that information then is going to be able to travel outside of borders, and it's not going to necessarily be contained in the United States.
We're talking about online privacy here on Midday. Our number 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. My guests are Professor Avi Rubin from Johns Hopkins and Melanie Teplinsky. She's from the law school at American University. We got a bunch of calls on the line. Let's go to one of them. Tom in Baltimore, welcome to Midday. Thanks for your call.
Good afternoon, Tom. And my name is Tom, and I just got a computer, and I'm new to the internet. I'm 72 years old, so I'm late for this technology. On the Windows 10 that's running, there's a digital assistant that calls itself by the name Cortana, and apparently it collects information to help me out. And you can ask it any question. Well, I asked it a question, are you spying on me? The answer was, no, I am artificial intelligence, not FBI, not NSA, not CIA. Can I trust it?
Sounds like Cortana was expecting that question from you and perhaps millions of other people. I mean, Avi, one of the things that's striking is that when it comes to, for example, location services, there are people who can figure out where you are even if you're not online. I mean, if you're just walking around with your phone in your pocket or in your purse, I mean, you don't have to be actively engaged on the internet for people to know exactly your longitude and latitude.
It's pretty amazing to me the degree to which what you're talking about is happening. There was an article published last week about a service that's running out there, ultrasonic sounds, that is sound waves that are not perceptible to humans but which can be understood by a phone or a computer, are being sent out in various locations. And apps are being deployed for the phone, and these are very common apps. They're games, they're purchasing apps that people might have on their phone, which are able to communicate with the source of that ultrasonic sound. And in that way, the person can be identified as being in a particular location. So imagine as you walk around your day, whether you're going to the mall or you're going to the supermarket or you're at the airport, and all of these beacons with ultrasonic sounds are sending sounds to your phone, and the phone is answering them, and now the network knows where you are, and so you can be targeted with particular ads, and that information can be collected and sold, and it might be valuable to a marketer to know that on this particular day, this particular person was over here. When you think of the privacy implications that that has for individuals, it's pretty staggering.
And Melanie Teplinsky, this bill that Congress signed, one of the things, as I understand it, that it accomplished is that it took away forever and ever any imprimatur or authority from the FCC to establish future privacy protections for consumers, right? Congress wants this power moved from the FCC or the FTC or any agency. They want it moved from there to Congress itself. Do I understand it correctly?
You do. So what Congress did was they prohibited the FCC from in the future making any rules that would be substantially similar to those that they had that had just been repealed. So that's correct.
Let's go to the phones. Ellen in Baltimore. Welcome to Midday with Melanie Toplinski and Avi Rubin.
Yeah, hi everybody. Listen, I'm going to try and summarize this, but I encourage everyone to go and look at the article on TheIntercept.com. But it's about the Oklahoma, where they've just passed two laws declaring, that that protesters for criminal penalties against people who trespass on property, what they call critical infrastructure facility, and not only will the people who trespass on those facilities, including sort of pipeline issues and stuff, there'll be a penalty and a minimum $10,000 fine, but the Oklahoma House also says that this bill will permit vicarious liability. So for anybody that compensates protesters accused of trespassing. So, for instance, I sent some money to help the horses in the South Dakota pipeline protest. You know, I could be liable to 10 times the fee, the fine of the people who actually did the protest. So this is a huge free speech issue. And they could have access to my emails and so on where I donated this money. So this is going to the whole idea of dampening, any kind of dissent, any kind of organization that wants to help in any way. This is absolutely terrifying. This is way beyond getting ads that you really don't want.
All right. Well, thank you for your call, Ellen. Melanie Toplinski, you worked at the NSA. I mean, what's your level of worry at this point, if you have any, about the capacity of the government to surveil its citizens?
Right. So I think there are two very different issues that we've been talking about. One has to do with the extent to which businesses and corporations collect and use our data for a variety of reasons, for business efficiencies and to make a profit and to improve the user experience. And the other has to do with how government engages in surveillance on citizens. And with respect to the latter, I think the reason that privacy is so important, to go back to your discussion with Fervin a few minutes ago, is that privacy doesn't just provide us secrecy as against the government. Privacy has always stood as a restraint on the power of our government since our founding days, and that's why it's been so important. So when you ask what makes me nervous about government surveillance, to me, I understand quite deeply the value of government surveillance in terms of protecting our citizenry and trying to protect against terrorist attacks, trying to understand threats to our nation. However, those security goals, in my view, should not be balanced against individual privacy, which is typically how the balance is weighed. Rather, we should be thinking about the value of privacy writ large as a restraint on how our government has power over us.
But if it's not going to be valued or balanced with individual privacy, how does it get balanced? I mean, what other thing is there to balance it with?
Right. So here's the example I like to give. In the criminal defense context, we give criminal defendants an enormous number of protections. We don't do that so that people who commit crimes won't go to jail. We do that because we're worried our government will get too powerful and abuse its power in certain ways. And so we're trying to protect all of us by giving individuals protections. I think of privacy in the same way. We do give individual protections to people, but the purpose of those protections is not to protect the secrecy of whether Melanie Toplinski is at the corner of Connecticut Avenue and Van Ness at 12 o'clock today, but rather it's that, writ broadly, if we don't have those protections, there isn't enough space for people to dissent from their government.
Let's see if we can grab one more phone call before we take a break. Frank in Aberdeen, welcome to Midday. Thanks for your call.
Good afternoon. I think you're getting to the essence of the problem, and that is there is a distinction between what private enterprise has to do and what the government can do. The good thing is if the government has your information, you have constitutional protections. With private industry, they have no obligation to you at all, and they can farm that information whatever way they need, First, it'll become manipulation, and then it will become control, and then one of them will become Big Brother.
Well, thanks for your call. Avi Rubin, you're in the computer business. I mean, there are private industry that are developing these new technologies at an incredibly quick pace. There's the government, our surveillance agencies. You know, we have, 17, 18 different, intelligence agencies. They're trying to do this kind of stuff, too. I mean, it's a bit of a muck, isn't it?
Yeah, I agree with half of what the caller said. I think that it's definitely a problem when private industry has their hands on all of this data that they're able to collect now. But I disagree that it's okay when the government has it for several reasons. One is that I don't necessarily trust the ability of every agency in the government that has this information that they are going to be able to protect that information from outsiders. I also don't necessarily trust that we won't end up with somebody untrustworthy inside of that government organization that would use this data for nefarious purposes. And I agree with the sentiment that we've had in this discussion, which is that we need to build our systems and our policies such that even in the face of an authoritarian government, we don't compromise on our civil liberties and our ability to come out against the government. And I think that the government holding all of that information gives the government power against the citizens, and I don't think that's a good thing.
Professor Avi Rubin, he's the technical director of the Information Security Institute at Johns Hopkins. Melanie Toplinski is a former NSA analyst who's worked on a wide range of information technology policy issues. She's currently on the faculty at the American University Law School. You are welcome to join us when we come back from a quick break. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, to follow us on Twitter, and we hope you will, @MiddayTomHall. Stick around. We will be right back.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, we're talking about cybersecurity and online privacy. Melanie Toplinski is a privacy expert and adjunct professor at American University's Washington College of Law. Avi Rubin is here with me in Studio A. He's a technical director of the Information Security Institute at Johns Hopkins, where he's also a professor of computer science. Our phone number at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. We hope you'll follow us on Twitter, @MiddayTomHall. So, Avi, let's talk about encryption and the controversy over that. A year or so ago, when the San Bernardino terrorist attack occurred, there was a big kerfluffle about Apple not releasing to the government information that was on the phones of the people who did the shooting. Eventually, the government figured out how to get that information. So this has been going on for a while. I mean, this debate started 20-something years ago. Where does it stand now? What are the things you think are most important about that?
Well, that's right. So in the 90s, we dealt with what was called then the encryption debates. The government wanted to put a backdoor into encryption so that if you had something that was going to encrypt information, which is basically applying a secret key to the information so that only authorized parties can see it. And the government wanted to put the backdoor in so that they could get access to all encrypted information. And that effort fell on its face in the 90s because the particular implementation that the government had put out had a flaw in it, a technical flaw that was uncovered. And here we are 20-something odd years later, and we're dealing with the same problem and the same question. And we've got a government that is making a lot of noise about making encryption require government access, a government backdoor. And there are a lot of reasons why I believe the technical community that deals with encryption thinks that's a really bad idea. One of the reasons is that the bad guys, the terrorists that they're worried about, already have access to internationally obtained encryption. That means that even if the U.S. makes it illegal to have encryption that doesn't have a backdoor, there's plenty of encryption software out there that can come from other countries and that the terrorists and the bad guys already have access to and are already using. So disallowing that in the U.S. is not going to affect the bad guys. The flip side of that is that when we put backdoors and we weaken our encryption, the U.S. businesses like the banks that are protecting our money and the businesses with which we communicate that are protecting our information are going to have a weakened access to protecting that information. And so the information we care about is going to be more at risk, whereas what we're trying to accomplish, which is to prevent the bad guys from having encryption, is not something that we can accomplish anymore.
And Melanie Toplinski, what do you say to the folks who say, look, I don't have anything to hide, I'm not a bad guy, and if they want to have this backdoor to the encryption so that they can identify and get the bad guys, that's fine with me, and I'm willing to give up my information because I couldn't care less, I'm not breaking the law.
I'd say it's not just about your information. Just because you don't have anything to hide doesn't mean you have nothing to gain from being able to use encryption. One example that I like to give is if we allow the United States government to request access through a back door, does that mean that when the United Arab Emirates comes knocking and requests access through a back door that we're going to say yes as well? Once we put in the back door, it can be used by everyone, as was just explained, and that includes hackers. Who can find access to our communications in that way and use that access to drain our bank accounts, right, to siphon IP out of the United States, intellectual property out of the United States by breaking into companies and stealing blueprints. Encryption is used to secure the backbone of our economy, our digital economy. And without that encryption being strong, meaning without it preventing it from having back doors, we don't have the strength that we need to continue.
Avi Rubin?
Yeah, so one of the things to think about is look at how many breaches are happening right now. Look at the state of internet security. And the strongest link that we have right now in a system is the encryption. And despite that strong link of encryption, we're getting so many systems broken into and exploited. The last thing that we need to do at this time is weaken what has been our strongest link by making encryption weaker.
Is there, however, ever going to be a possibility? Let's say this happens. Encryption is not made weaker. Would there be situations in which the lack of encryption or the way to get through the encryption could help law enforcement find the bad guys?
There is no doubt. People like to throw around the example of, you know, there's a bomb counting down and there's a phone that's got that information, or there's a child molester somewhere, and if you could decrypt their phone, you could get information. And there are going to be countless of examples that can be put forward of times when breaking encryption would be very valuable. But I think that if we look at society as a whole and we look at the fact that we have very important things that need to be protected on computer systems, and the best way that we know to protect them is through encryption. And I don't think it's technically feasible to build a backdoor that achieves exactly the weakening of encryption for law enforcement that they need in order to get in, but doesn't weaken it for anybody else.
Spoken as a computer expert, I should add. Joshua in Baltimore, welcome to Midday. Thanks for your call.
Thanks for taking my call, Tom. I just want to briefly ask, and Jen, I guess, how the people who make these mechanisms, how do they protect themselves from getting all their data stolen? And, you know, the ball just seems to keep advancing and further and selling more and more. You know, I guess unless the rich people have some kind of special encryption that isn't already been hacked, you know, we're all going to be subject to the same thing. And 30 years down the line, we'll all be screwed.
Yeah, that's a great question, Joshua. Avi, what do you think?
So it's the case right now that we have encryption publicly available, standard, that we don't know how to break. And it exists in the U.S. and it exists in other countries, and anyone can go to the computer and download encryption that is good enough today. And the way people are breaking systems is not by breaking or cracking the encryption. It's by finding the keys or finding a bug in an implementation or seeing that someone didn't implement something with the right parameters that they were supposed to use in that system. And so I think that what we should not be doing is looking at ways of weakening the one part of a system that we actually know works pretty well, but rather we should look at other techniques for law enforcement to get what they need to get when they have the appropriate warrant, et cetera, and that weakening the encryption is just not the answer to that.
Melanie, we have an email from Brian who says, I think the only way we'll get those in Congress to understand how invasive not having these privacy rules in place is for someone to publish a minute-by-minute, site-by-site, search-by-search transcript of the ISP information from members of Congress. That would get their attention and cause them to rethink their policy. What do you think about that?
I think it's wonderful that you raised that example. A few years ago, there was a law professor out of New York who put together a dossier of information on Antonin Scalia. Justice Scalia had spoken recently, before this, about privacy. And he essentially said what you said earlier. He said, if I have nothing to hide, why do I need privacy? So I believe it was Professor Rydenburg out of New York. He assigned his students a semester-long project to pull together all of Justice Scalia's information. And he was successful in finding Justice Scalia's home phone number, the names of his grandchildren, what they like to eat, where they like to go. It is very effective. And in the past, Congress has passed laws when their personal information has been targeted. We saw this with the Video Records Protection Act, which came out after the video rental records of then-nominee Judge Bork came out publicly. Congress got concerned that their video record rentals might be public, too. And as a result, we got the Video Privacy Protection Act. I'm not advocating that people go out and collect the information about what Congress people do. But I think it is important for people to understand the full implications of what it means when all of our private information is vacuumed up into large databases that are available to the highest bidder.
You can imagine members of Congress shaking in their boots when people might realize how many times they rented on Golden Pond. Yeah, I bet. Avi, I got another computer expert question here. This comes from Jeff, who says, recently I verbally, not over the phone, not texted, I verbally told my fiance that we should consider purchasing a new bed. And shortly after, I started seeing targeted ads about beds and mattresses on Facebook and Google. I mean, it's not possible. Can we reassure Jeff that those ads did not appear because they overheard their conversation?
I can't actually reassure him. I don't believe that that's how it happened. I believe what more likely happened is that after that suggestion, his fiance went out and started researching beds online. And so then when he was browsing the web, he started to see the ads, if they were using the same computer or the same Amazon account.
Melanie, we have an email from Rob who says, if the private ISP is able to collect the data that it wants, data the government cannot or should not collect, isn't it just a subpoena for the government to get that information from the ISP, something easy to get under anti-terrorism laws?
It depends, actually, on the specifics of the situation. Yes, there are some situations in which the government can get access to specific information by way of a subpoena, and there are other situations in which law enforcement is required to get a warrant. But it depends in particular on what exactly law enforcement is seeking. The general rule is that when content is sought, that the content of a communication is sought, a warrant is required, and when metadata, meaning if you think of an envelope, if the letter inside the envelope is sought, then a warrant is required. If the address information from the outside of the envelope is being requested, then a subpoena is sufficient.
And Avi, we just got 30 seconds left. What's your level of concern and worry about things like cyber theft and, you know, someone breaking in and destroying the electric grid and, you know, terrorism using cyber holes in cybersecurity?
Well, I think that as we move more and more things online and as we become more dependent on computer networks, we do run the risks of these things becoming unavailable or getting compromised. So I think we need to look at the security implications of all of our decisions that we make with respect to what we do on the Internet.
Thank you very much, both of you, Avi Rubin and Melanie Teplinsky. I really appreciate it. It's been a fun conversation.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Avi Rubin is the Technical Director of the Information Security Institute at Johns Hopkins. He's also a professor of computer science. Melanie Teplinsky is a privacy expert and adjunct professor at American University's Washington College of Law. We've got more information on our very unsecure website, wipr.org/ Midday. That's it for us today. Join us tomorrow for a conversation with the novelist Madison Smart Bell about his terrific new novel, Behind the Moon. We want to thank our friends at WAMU in Washington for their help today, and thanks to Joe Squared for providing lunch. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers, locations and hours at joesquared.com. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you've been with us. I appreciate it. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a good day.